Okay, this man, I like this guy.
I want from White Plains. Amen. Okay? We have a problem in this country. It's called Muslims. We know our current president is one. Right. You know he's not even an American.
We need this first question. Certificate, this man. First question.
But anyway, we have training camps growing where they want to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. When can we get rid of it?
We're going to be looking at a lot of different things. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, and a lot of people are saying that bad things are happening out there. We're going to be looking at that and plenty of other things. Okay, go ahead. Yes, ma'am.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Yeah, I got to tell you, you know, you look at some of the, you look at the campaign and you go back to the right-wing victimization, how they're the ones being attacked. This rewriting of history, this just kind of, you know, the people that we used to say were, you know, cranks and way out on the extreme seem to now be always front and center. And I look at, you know, just the news over the weekend, which evidently these couple of kids didn't read, you know, Shakespeare as I had to in school, didn't read Julius Caesar, complaining that the scene in which the senators kill Caesar and stab him was actually too bloody. That's one of their big complaints. They made it too bloody and they made Caesar look like Donald Trump. So that's the reason, I guess, a couple of these nitwits decided that they were going to make a scene. And look, you know, God bless them. They made their scene. They got thrown out. It is what it was. But the question comes back to, you know, one, Julius Caesar was going on all during the Obama administration. And no one seemed to protest that. Corporate sponsors didn't seem to pull out of that. Why now? That's why I've asked a person who was actually in the audience of this this performance to come talk with us, our good friend Andrea Chalupa. Andrea, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So am I getting this right? You had a couple of nitwits who were screaming Goebbels and fascism and other nonsense?
Yeah, it was pretty hilarious for all of us who were there.
So did you think it was part of the scene? Because I was told that this was a rewriting of Shakespeare. A couple of the right-wing nitwits who reached out said, they rewrote it.
It was the beautiful language of Shakespeare. When the performance begins, they let you know that one line has been changed, and you'll know which line it was. And so later in the play, when you hear the line, it's about how Julius Caesar is so popular, he could stab someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. So we all know what that was referring to. It was Trump, of course, when he said during the election that he's so popular, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for him. So that was the only line in all of Shakespeare that was, in Julius Caesar, that was changed.
Well, there's a perfect reason to, you know, to get up and scream and carry on, right?
Well, it was pretty ridiculous what they did. I mean, the show itself had this really riveting, interactive spirit. So you'd have extras pop up from the audience and jump onto the stage and join the action on the stage. So the one point that's not being made in the mainstream media that you have to pay attention to is that, you know, Julius Caesar was modeled after Trump, complete with a wife with a Slovakian accent. And even Mark Antony came off as, like, very sycophantic, you know, Kellyanne Conway-like. But then you had the resistance, Brutus and the others, and they came off as Women's March and March for Truth and all the other marches. Like, they would, you know, you'd see them. So when the battle scenes were happening in Caesar, it was this totalitarian state, you know, under Mark Antony versus actual protesters. You know, with shouting resistance slogans that we're all used to by now, you know, this is what democracy looks like and other things. And so basically, if conservatives can complain about Julius Caesar being killed and he looks like Trump, and that's, you know, in the play, we in the resistance could make the same argument. Well the resistance, our resistance, including our, you know, our slogans, that we came off as violent and extremist, but you don't see us in an uproar and arguing that and protesting the play, because what the play is ultimately saying is a valuable message that all of us need to hear is that violence is bad, that violence just makes things worse. Don't be violent.
Yeah, but that, again, that takes some thought. It isn't right out in front. You have to actually think about that for a second.
Right. you actually have to know Shakespeare or, you know, attended some English classes, I guess, in high school or paid attention. And clearly these two, you know, Laura Loomer and her partner, Jack, whatever his name is, those two that disrupted the show, they just made themselves look completely foolish and just publicly outed themselves in a major way, having no idea what the play is actually about.
Yeah, well, on Twitter, he made himself out to be, you know, this great crusader who was going to teach the weak and the timid how to move forward. And yet, a couple of tweets later, he complains that he was going to basically go tell mom. He was going to report somebody and stop harassing me. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I Lauren Duca, like, fact-checked him or, you know, said something funny to him, and he melted. He freaked out. So I think when you hold stupid, inhumane positions, as the far right does, it's a cowardly position to take. So if your values are cowardly, you're clearly cowardly. And all Laura Loomer and Jack, you know, expose to themselves that they're in effect cowards. Like even when, so being in the audience that Friday night, even when Jack stood up, so Laura Loomer jumped on stage, did her thing, screamed whatever, the show stopped. And then right after that, Jack stood up in the middle of the audience with his phone out as though he was filming. And he just kept like, shouting at all of us, calling us Nazis repeatedly. And it was almost like his brain had turned off because he was so scared and didn't know what else to do or say.
Yeah.
You kind of felt sorry for them. And like, the whole audience just had a field day with them and just started like, we all like rose to our feet and did a whole standing ovation and really applauding the bravery of the production, applauding the bravery of the actors, and really applauding for our right to be there in a free democracy where, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of speech is something that we value as a nation.
Yeah, but I understand that.
It turned out to be a beautiful moment.
Yeah, you could actually think it was part of the play.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's what it was like at first. But, you know, but really, the reason why I was so quick to pick up on it is because, you know, going into the theater that night, you had two or three old white men, really grizzly, you know, flannel shirts, unshaven, you know, they're protesters, these two or three, you know, old grizzly white men. And they were screaming at us as we're coming to the theater about, like, how we're all George Soros funded and just ridiculous stuff that you hear from Breitbart News. And then right across from them, you had some young kids who, you know, that I've seen at marches against Trump. And you know, they're part of a group that really is very vocal about how we have to stand up against the early tremors of fascism and taking the threat very seriously. And they do very good work at really filling out these demonstrations against Trump. So you had two from that group that were there, and they were there shouting against Trump's hateful agenda and really saying that we live in a democracy and how we have to, you know, fight for that. And so the two, even though the protesters were very small in number, the two sides were, you know, trying to out-scream each other. And so everybody that was there was really sort of aware that there was something happening that night. It just felt like some sort of an electrical current in the air that that we were on the front lines of a very big show. It wasn't just going to be another night at the theater.
Yeah, now I understand this was the last show, right?
Yes, so now it's coming to a close, and that's how it saw off its season, was with making history, with basically showing that the far right is ignorant, and that pranksters like Laura Loomer and her partner Jack, they clearly did this for an attention grab and for money, and you see that even like, you know, people like other far right voices like Ben Shapiro and Baked Alaska, those guys have taken them to task on Twitter and harassed them on Twitter for their stupid prank and just called them snowflakes or whatever for, you know, being so triggered by a play, including, you know, a play that's even got like a good moral message for all of Americans, you know. So it really, the whole stunt backfired on them. They may have gotten rich because they set up a GoFundMe page because Laura was arrested, but they, you know, Jordan Ewell of the opposition, who I spoke to earlier, he flagged that the GoFundMe page for Laura Loomer to bail her out was already set up before the show even started.
Wow.
It was almost like, you know, yeah. So it was very clear that this was just like a money-making scheme, and they raked in money because people are idiots. And so... It's going to be really obnoxious if we see this whole sort of like shock jock activism take over where people just become pranksters. But, you know, at the same time, I have faith that people are going to shout them down. And after a while, they're just going to get so tired of making fools of themselves.
Yeah, but as long as there's somebody out there to give them money, I don't know that they'll ever get tired of making fools of themselves. But for me, the bigger picture also is the right wing playing the victim. And they do it so well. That, you know, I saw statements of, you know, we got to stop normalizing political violence against the right, and we've got to stop normalizing violence against Donald Trump. And I saw all these statements, and you're going, wait a second, did I miss something?
Right. It's bizarre. Just sort of, I think the far right is just embarrassing in the conservative movement as a whole. And it's to the point where it's the Republican leaders themselves have to unite and clean their own house, or else this is going to get really bad. Yeah. And it doesn't look, you know, unless the Russians come in and successfully hack the vote tallies this time around in 2018 and 2020, I can't imagine the Republicans are going to do well. I think people are largely tired of the fire hose of chaos coming out of the White House. Even, you know, business leaders, they just had a CEO summit at Yale, and CEOs overwhelmingly gave Trump an F grade or a D grade, mostly F. And so, you know, I think it doesn't matter who you are, how much money you have, at a certain point, you're just tired of the buffoonery, and you're tired of an insane, petulant, screaming toddler in the White House with, you know, surrounded by, like, literal Nazis like Bannon and Gorka. You're tired of that embarrassment, that shame on the world stage. And at a certain point, you set a break. And so these far-right pranksters are just part of that vile filth that I think Republican voices themselves are getting tired of.
No, I'm with you. But here's the thing. Since you brought up Russia and bizarre almost in the same sentence, what seems bizarre to me is how the right has really taken on in this Russia love fest, and also some on the left. I mean, yesterday I had a conversation with David Swanson, you know, who basically said there's nothing there. There's no Russian involvement, nothing there. But he, in his defense, he did point out that, no, we need to fix our electoral system. We need to end the money. We need to end gerrymandering. There's a lot that we need to do. He just didn't think Russia had anything to do with it.
Yeah, well, that's extremely irresponsible to think that. I mean, I know that some on the far left take a very sympathetic attitude towards Putin's Russia, which is horrible for, which is a hurtful position to take for the Russian opposition and the liberals who are suffering under Putin's a deeply corrupt regime. You have to understand that, everyone has to understand that the Russian people themselves are suffering under Putin's kleptocracy. I think the far left, some in the far left take that position because, you know, like any thinking person, they're anti-war. And they assume that if we fact-check the Russian regime's aggression, if we call it out, if we confront it, then that's going to pull us into war. And Putin feeds on that by saber-rattling and having these massive military drills inside Russia, including drills preparing the country for nuclear war. And so, you know, some in the far left see that and they get anxious and they take a position that is against reality by making absurd claims that Russia wasn't, you know, involved in 2016 election hacking when, you know, when federal agencies, you know, have come out with evidence and we've seen multiple congressional testimonies in detail describing how they did it and how they'll do it again and how they're still doing it. So, you know, we have to make friends with reality, and we have to, you know, use this moment as a teaching moment to understand how we can keep our system safe from any hostile regime, any regime whatsoever. And that's what these Russiagate investigations are affording us. It's a urgently needed massive learning opportunity, so we make sure this never happens again. And furthermore, you know, those on the far left who take this sympathetic position towards Putin's kleptocratic regime, they have to understand that no one wants war with Russia, and in fact, Russia can't afford a war. The U.S., you know, at this point, can't afford a war because we just too many conflicts that we've created that we're continuing to mess up today. And it's really sanctions,
right,
that we're relying on that have a wonderful effect for For instance, when Putin first invaded Ukraine, he had a dream. His whole propaganda, his rhetoric, when he was first invaded Ukraine, was about creating new Russia, what he was calling Nova Russia, where he wanted to take back a large swath of land from Ukraine to sort of fulfill the empire of Russia, of his dreams. And he stopped very short of that because the sanctions bit him and contained him. So, you know, no one wants war with Russia. They want, you know, it's all about having a strategy of banks, not tanks.
I mean, what's interesting to me, though, is there's just all of this conversation about Russia. And look, you know, it keeps being thrown out that, you know, he invaded Crimea. And when there was a vote that went on, and look, most of us aren't versed in Russian history or any of that. But, you know, he brought up the fact that, you know, there was a vote and the people of Crimea wanted to be Russian.
Oh, that's ridiculous. It was a referendum by gunpoint. The two choices on the ballot were like, you know, Crimea goes to Russia or Crimea goes to Russia. That was an invasion masked as a referendum. And anybody who buys the Kremlin's propaganda on that needs to, you know, read mainstream news sources and not, you know, not be so mistrustful of the New York Times and the Washington Post, despite whatever mistakes they've made in the past. You have to trust, you know, widespread reporting that the Crimea referendum was a fake referendum that was done. It was not legitimate by any standard. They didn't have international observers there, save for far-right pundits who came in as sort of like a, you know, parade of propaganda. The whole thing was just such a charade, and everybody, international observers and journalists, documented that widely, you know, across international press. So to fall for the Kremlin's propaganda that Crimeans voted for to join Russia, that's just absurd, completely absurd. Yeah. And Crimea today, oh my God, Crimea today under Russia is a human rights cesspool. You have, you know, media getting shut down. You have militias that harass or kidnap or kill activists. So, you know, you've had people who have disappeared and not be found. You have someone like the Crimean filmmaker Oleg Sentsov, whose films have premiered at European festivals. Oleg Sentsov was just an activist, like you and I are activists, or you know, whoever we know are activists. You know, he was one of us in that sense. And Russian militia, when they invaded Crimea, they kidnapped Oleg Sentsov and took him to Russia and quote unquote sentenced him to 20 years in a Russian prison for his activism. And Penn International, leading filmmakers from across Europe and the U.S., they've done campaigns demanding his freedom, that he be freed. And to this day, he's still a political prisoner inside Russia. So anybody who tries to defend the Kremlin's invasion of Crimea, like that to me is just, I don't understand. Like that's completely like willful ignorance, and just it's just harmful.
Yeah, and for me, the reason I look at all this stuff, and again, I'm not an expert on Russian politics or history, but you know, you look at all of this disinformation on both the right and the left, and where it comes together on the right and left. That's the kind of stuff that's very troublesome to me.
Absolutely, and I think you know, people on the far left and far right have to get away from their sort of echo chambers and read widely when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, and read widely not only news sources and not only columns, but also books from that part of the world. You know, read Ukrainian literature, read Russian literature, you know, the good translations, just to get a sense of who these people are and not allow this hot conflict that has spilled over to the U.S. Through this, you know, unprecedented 2016 Russian meddling. Just to understand that it's beyond just sound bites. It's beyond just, you know, political infighting in the U.S. These are like real lives at stake, democracies at stake, and there's a lot to come because Putin's, you know, getting up in years. He's going to pass away at some time. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens to Russia once Putin is gone, whether the cult of personality can outlive him, whether, you know, sort of his entourage, whether the infighting will destroy them or whether they could have a transition into like the next Putin that comes along, or whether this burgeoning youth movement of kids who grew up with the internet inside Russia, you're seeing their protests every other month. There's a wonderful protest by these brave young Russian people who are risking their freedom by standing out there. So it's going to. So this is a part of the world that's going to continue to shape us here at home. The discussions we're having, the policies, all of it. Our elections, sadly, even. So people have to really get their facts straight and read widely.
Yeah. Do you agree with his? He wrote a piece called "Everyone Should Visit Russia," and he's got a whole bunch of wonderful reasons why we should visit. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, I prefer St. Petersburg if you go anywhere inside Russia. Moscow, I think a lot has changed since I visited in 2006. But yeah, I definitely recommend St. Petersburg for sure.
There you go.
And I recommend highly Ukraine. If you get a chance, Kiev is one of the greenest cities in all of Europe, and it's beautiful. It's very bohemian, as well as Lviv in the west.
Yeah, the last time I heard anything about Kiev, there were bombs going off.
Well, it was a bomb was thrown in at the U.S. embassy, I believe, and you know, since Rex Tillerson has taken over as Secretary of State, you know, Rex Tillerson is somebody who has willingly, significantly reduced America's funding for human rights and democracy initiatives at the State Department, which deliberately shrinks America's soft power around the world. We're talking about funding that goes to independent journalists in cities like Kiev, you know, money that goes to civic leaders. Just to give you an example of what money Rex Tillerson is taking out of the State Department budget for some odd reason, you know, I have friends in Kiev who are investigative journalists. They founded an online independent news network called Hromadske TV. They did this because they got tired of working at a oligarch-owned TV network because censorship was coming from the top. So they jumped ship and they, you know, got grant money, whatever they needed to do, and they founded this independent online TV network. And once it got up and running, one of them, this Afghani-Ukrainian investigative journalist named Mustafa Nayem, he launched the revolution in Ukraine with a Facebook post. And, you know, when the revolution was successful, he and some of his friends became members in parliament, and they've led some of the most effective anti-corruption reforms Ukraine has ever had. So, you know, it's people like that are funded by these State Department programs, and that's what Rex Tillerson is taking away. And who would that benefit? That would benefit Putin. Putin's propaganda machine labeled Ukraine's revolution as being, you know, U.S.-funded, because of programs like that. And he tried to sort of blame the U.S. On the revolution. But as Ukrainians themselves who led it and did it and even defied the U.S. and the EU in a number of examples during the revolution. So it just goes to show that everyone's waiting for some grand bargain between Putin and Trump when it's already happened in the form of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State and, you know, pulling out the rug from these civic society leaders and investigative journalists around the world, allowing Russia to swoop in and you know, fund them instead and spread Russia's influence around the world. So Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, is very dangerous and a gift to Putin.
Yeah. It just seems to me a lot of arrows point back to Russia again, why I think we absolutely need an investigation, why we need to get to the bottom of it, and just... it just makes sense to me. Andrea, I appreciate the thoughts. I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thank you so much, Rick. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Look forward to talking again real soon. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.